Mr. Smith, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This federal income tax case, Commissioner versus Kowalski, is here on certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. It presents a single question with two subparts: whether cash payments to state police troopers, of whom Kowalski was one, which are designated as meal allowances, are includable in gross income under Section 61A of the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, and are not otherwise excludable from income under a special exclusion provision, Section 119, which came into the tax law at the time of the 1954 codification. In a brief per curiam opinion, the Third Circuit reversed a reviewed decision of the tax court with respect to both code sections and held that the meal payments in question here were not gross income, and even if they were excludable under Section 119. We submit that the Court of Appeals erred as to both points, that the cash payments are gross income, as that fundamental term in the tax law is defined by Section 61A, and that the cash payments here do not qualify for the limited exclusion provided by Section 119 of the Code, which briefly provides for an exclusion for meals furnished by an employer to his employee for the convenience of the employer, but only if the meals are furnished on the employer's business premises. So in this sense, the Section 61A aspect of the Court of Appeals decision is the most troublesome and extraordinary one from our point of view, because it holds that a cash payment by an employer to his employee to defray the cost of what is indisputably a personal expense, the cost of eating lunch during the day, does not fit within the statutory phrase gross income from whatever source derived. I think that I can set forth the facts briefly. They're undisputed.
Mr. Smith, before you do, in your brief on page 6, you say the tax court unanimously held that the cash payments did not qualify for the exclusion from gross income under Section 119. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. There were five or six dissents on the Section 61 point, but no one dissented on the Section 119 point. Judge Sterritt wrote a dissenting opinion joined by five judges, set forth at pages 32A to 37A of Appendix A to the petition, which concluded that the amounts were not gross income under Section 61. He didn't reach the other. I suppose one might say he didn't reach the other point, although there was no expression of disagreement in the tax court on the Section 119 point.
That sounds like the case we just heard.
Mr. Smith, while we have you there, you have in mind that when a judge, federal judge, is assigned to another circuit, or if in his regular duties a district judge goes to another station to sit, he is given a $50 a day allowance if he identifies the expenditures, so much for his room and so much for meals and whatnot. Now, since the judge presumably eats breakfast, lunch, and dinner when he's home, bear in mind at some point at your convenience, would you tell me what you think of that situation under this provision or anyone like it? Would the judge be required to treat as income the breakfast, lunch, and
Mr. Chief Justice, the proper tax treatment, it would seem to me, of that situation would be as follows: the judge would, unless there were a complete wash. Let me back up for a moment. As a theoretical matter, all of those payments are part of gross income. Moreover, the amounts expended for meals when away from home overnight under this court's Correll decision are a deductible business expense under Section 162 of the Code.
Well, but that's not true of a federal judge. That's not true of a federal judge. He has business expenses in the sense that you're...
Well, but he has employee business expenses. That if an employee is away from home overnight and expends money in aid of his business, which is the business of being an employee, those expenses are deductible. So to follow through on your example, the judge would include all of this, these per diem payments in income and take corresponding deductions. It may well be, given the high cost of living these days and the particular plight that federal judges find themselves in, that there will be a net deficit, in which case there will be a net deduction. It's possible if the judge is frugal that there may be a net amount of income. Now, the Internal Revenue Service, by regulation, takes the position that if an employee must make an accounting to his employer and there is a complete wash, you don't have to report the actual items on the return, but you must append a statement to your return saying that you've had per diem payments, you've had business expenses, and that they net out against each other. So this enables the Internal Revenue Service to be alerted to the fact that there are these items on the return, and if they want to audit...
You mean all these years I've been misreporting?
Mm-hmm. What have you been
to a judicial
without making...
I've never put this on my return.
You've never put the statement on your return?
Neither statement.
Well, in preparing for this case, I've been advised that there is such a requirement.
You think I better disqualify myself in this case?
Absolutely not. I don't think it's a mandatory requirement. It's a permissive requirement.
Mr. Smith, your answer to the Chief Justice's question that these allowances in any event are gross income leads me to this question, which may be at the very outer bounds of relevancy, but that won't stop me from asking it. As I understand, the past three or four presidents of the country have received what are called tax-free expense allowances in addition to their salaries. Now, are those gross income for those persons?
Well, I suspect probably not if they're tax-free. And I'm not familiar with that, but that may well be by special statute that, you know, the statute authorizing the president's salary may provide for a tax-free allowance, very much like the military has certain tax-free allowances.
So that simply depends on the wording of the particular statute.
Right. We're getting back to the more mundane factual context in which this case arose.
And the mundane factor of federal judges. You don't distinguish them, do you? You don't distinguish federal judges from state highway patrolmen, do you, for these purposes?
For these purposes, we're all taxpayers. I don't even exclude myself from the circle of taxpayers. This respondent is a New Jersey state police trooper. And in 1970, he had a base salary of $8,739. He received an additional amount, which the state designated as a meal allowance, which for 1970 was $1,697. This meal allowance was, like the salary, paid biweekly, but unlike the salary, it was paid in advance, and the salary was paid for prior periods.
Is there any significance in that payment in advance?
I don't think so.
Somewhere in your argument, will you differentiate in the services treatment of military allowances of this kind and the state trooper's allowance and tell us precisely why one is in and one is out?
I shall. This meal allowance is described on a New Jersey police recruitment brochure as an item to be received in addition to salary. It's clearly an important aspect of the trooper's compensation. The amount of the meal allowance is a subject of negotiations between the police troopers union and the state, and in fact has gone up over the years. It used to be $70 a month, and now it ranges from $1,740 for troopers like Respondent Kowalski, $1,776 for lieutenants and captains, and $2,136 for the commander of the of the New Jersey State Police, the superintendent colonel. So There is a variation in amount depending upon your rank. The meal allowances are also significantly included in the compensation base on which the troopers' pension benefits are computed. Now, under the cash meal allowance system, the troopers are expected to eat within their assigned patrol area. So, and what they have to do is when they're going to go to lunch, when I use lunch, I'm really talking about a mid-shift meal. I'm just using lunch as an example. They have to check in with the officer in charge and tell them they will be at such and such a restaurant and they will be there for lunch. Now, there's no restrictions on the cash payments because the troopers can eat at home if they wish, if they live within their assigned duty area. They can eat in a public restaurant, as I suggested, or they can even take their lunch, take a sandwich from home and eat in their patrol car if they so desire. The amount of the meal allowance is not calculated at all to provide any kind of reimbursement for any specific amount of meals. It's simply a flat amount per year, in this case, $1,740. On his 1970 return, Respondent Kowalski reported his $9,000 in wages, which included a base salary of $8,739 and cash meal allowances of $326. Now, the reason he reported part of this cash meal allowance on his 1970 return is, I think, significant. He reported it because the state of New Jersey in October 1970, that is, for the final quarter of this taxable year, changed its policy and began to include the cash meal allowances on the Form W-2 of their troopers. So the Internal Revenue Service began to be advised formally of the fact that these troopers were receiving these additional amounts. But Respondent Kowalski did not report the remaining $1,371 portion for the first 9 months of 1970 because that wasn't included on his Form W-2. Now, the only reason this sort of came to the Internal Revenue Service's attention, and in one respect, this aspect of the case is really significant for purposes of the second case because it shows the importance of the need for the Internal Revenue Service to withhold on cash payments from an employer to an employee at the source. But the reason the Internal Revenue Service found out about it is because they disallowed Respondent Kowalski's travel expenses. And after Respondent Kowalski filed his petition in the tax court and the service filed its answer and began to engage in a deeper kind of discovery, they discovered the fact that he had this additional $1,371 by happenstance of this litigation, and then filed an amended answer which raised the issue, which is before
Mr. Smith, you're not suggesting the Internal Revenue Service is ignorant of this kind of practice among...
No, I'm not suggesting...
These cases have been kicking around here for over a decade.
Oh, for more than a decade, Mr. Justice Blackmun, actually. Yes. No, I'm not suggesting that, but what I was trying to emphasize is the fact that the withholding requirements are very important, and I will address this in greater detail in the Central Illinois case, but I wanted to simply say that the withholding requirements are very important to the service in terms of ensuring that taxes are collected on employee compensation. Because basically the service is set up on its computers that it would treat items on Form W-2s as the basic compensation of an employee. And it's only when matters are going to audit, like this case, that you have the happenstance of discovering an additional amounts that are not reported on a Form W-2.
You're not suggesting that what the employer thinks it ought to do governs his tax consequences.
Absolutely not. In fact, he
has to explain it in some way if it's on the W-2 form, and hence it's perfectly natural for him to report it or make some reference to it on his
absolutely
return.
Not. But the point I was simply making is that when something isn't on a Form W-2, it's more than likely that the service, in the normal kind of tax administration, absent a deep audit, is not going to be aware of a payment, of a cash payment made by an employer to an employee.
Let me try this hypothetical on you. I suppose in a state trooper situation, they have a base somewhere with the radio dispatcher that communicates with all the cars. Now, the dispatcher, let's assume also the dispatcher is on duty 9 hours a day. That's the term of his employment. And he is required by the terms of the employment to eat on the premises and go down to the cafeteria and pick up a tray and bring it back to his gear, his broadcasting gear, and remain on duty throughout the lunch period in order to handle calls to and from troopers in the field. Would you say that was deductible? That was part of gross income?
Mr. Chief Justice, is this a meal in kind that's provided
What they do, to save bookkeeping, they just allow him to go down and get a free meal.
But it's a meal provided in kind by the employer to be eaten on the employer's business premises.
Right,
I would think that would be covered by the exclusion of Section 119.
Wouldn't it be gross income?
Oh, it would be gross. Well, no, because Section 119 says it's not gross. In other words,
except for 119, it would be.
Except for 119, it would be gross income because Section 61A begins except as otherwise provided in this subtitle. And this subtitle includes Section 119.
Now, suppose the rules of the state troopers required them at mealtime to drive to a restaurant, get the food in the restaurant, and then bring it into the car and eat it in the car so they'd be within reach of their radio at all times. Would you say that was...
That would not be a meal in kind provided by the employer. They would be paying cash for this meal. In other words, Section 119 clearly, and by legislative history and the regulations, provide you've got to meet three requirements. Number one, it must be a meal in kind provided by the employee. Number two, it must be for the convenience of the employer. And number three, it must be furnished on the business premises. In your example,
two of those requirements are clearly met, aren't they, in my last hypothetical?
Well, I suppose it would be for the convenience of the employer that...
And it's on the premises if he's eating in the car, isn't he?
Although I suppose it would be a debatable question whether the meal were furnished on the business premises if you had to go to a public restaurant to get it. But I think you wouldn't meet the question of meal in kind if in effect you're getting a cash payment to go buy a meal in a restaurant and eat it. And the statute clearly provides you've got to meet all three requirements under Section 119, otherwise you flunk the test.
Well, then let's back up to my radio dispatcher again. And the state authorities decide it's too expensive to maintain in the barracks cafeteria, and so they dispense with it, but say to the radio operator, you must be on duty, and he sends across the street to McDonald's or someplace.
That would be gross income because it would not be a meal in kind furnished by the employer.
In other words, the key to it is they've got to furnish the food.
Exactly. In fact, that's really what happened in this case, and that's what the respondents have argued. Because the state of New Jersey used to have a kind of meal station system, which they abandoned in favor of this cash allowance. And the respondents have argued here that, and throughout this case, that because it was done on a meal station basis before, that makes the cash payments non-taxable. Now, we basically have two answers to this. First, there's nothing in the record that permits an inference that the meal station allowance, this meal station system of former days, would have been non-taxable. In fact, it really turned out to be for the inconvenience of the employer, because the state of New Jersey found that people were driving all around the state to eat their meals and actually turned out to be quite far from their duty stations. And our second answer to this is...
How does that bear on the tax question?
Well, it bears on the tax question.
They can deal with that sort of a problem by discipline.
Well, no, it does bear on the tax question, Mr. Chief Justice, because the Section 119, one of its requirements is that the meals be furnished for the convenience of the employer. And if it turns out, as I'm suggesting, that the meals turned out to be inconvenient for the employer, I would suggest that you don't meet the statutory test. But putting that aside for a moment, I think that the court has said on a number of instances in National Alfalfa and Central Tablet Manufacturing Company, simply the fact that you could do it one way and achieve a particular tax result doesn't mean that if you do it another way, which may be virtually equivalent from a surface point of view, that will achieve the same tax result. Each case has to be judged on its facts. Now, I do want to talk...
One point. I don't know what... These men working 8-hour shifts?
I think so.
Well, what do you need lunch during an 8-hour shift?
I think they get an hour off or time off for lunch within that 8-hour shift. Now, it's possible it may be a 9-hour shift with an hour for lunch.
Yeah. Well, the other point is... Is there anything in the record that shows that they need special food or anything like that?
No.
This is just a run-of-the-mill lunch?
No, they're allowed. They basically can go wherever they want to eat lunch. Essentially, it's just as if my employer or anyone's employer simply said, we're going to give you $2 more a day to eat lunch. And we submit that those cash payments are compensation for services under Section 61A1, and that they don't meet the special limited exclusion of Section 119, which Congress channeled these three requirements, and they've all got to be met.
It had nothing to do with overtime.
Nothing to do with overtime at all.
Mr. Smith, suppose your employer, in the case you put, says you may not leave the factory premises during lunch. Would that make a difference?
That would not make a difference in our view, because that restriction might, and that basically is this case, because that restriction might be for the convenience of the employer, but the cash payment doesn't serve the convenience of the employer. The employer must provide the meals. And Congress said so specifically that in the committee report in Section 119 in reporting it out, that this provision only applies to meals in kind. It's not
so that your case really comes down to whether the refund is in cash or whether there is the
function. Absolutely. That's critical. The cash aspect of it is critical to the eligibility under Section 119. And we submit that cash payments are never eligible for exclusion under Section 119. I don't want to forget to turn to the tax treatment of the military, as Justice Blackmun asked. The military have always been a special case under the tax law, as well as generally. I think this court's decisions indicate that the military have been treated differently. Now, the origin of the treatment of the military arose in the Jones case, which the Court of Claims decided in the 1920s. The Court of Claims decided that cash allowances, housing allowances to the military would not be taxable income. And although the service had resisted it at the time, after the Jones decision, the service changed its position that cash subsistence payments to military personnel were includable in gross income, and ruled that such allowances were not includable in gross income. Now, after that, that position of the Internal Revenue Service was ultimately found its way into the regulations. I think it's 1.61-2B of the regulations. So following the Jones decision, the service, the Treasury, has for the last 50 years treated the military quite differently. Now, during this last 50 years, the code has, the tax law has been codified twice, in 1939 and in 1954, and Congress was aware of the Treasury regulations providing for this special treatment to what turned out to be not just the military, but the uniformed services, which includes the Coastal and Geodetic Survey and the Public Health Service as well. And Congress never expressed any opinion that this was not to be the governing rule. And in fact, in 37 U.S.C. 101, which we quote at page 19 of our brief, Congress explicitly confirmed the understanding that regular military compensation includes, quote, federal tax advantages accruing to aforementioned quarters and subsistence allowances. Now, the respondents in this case have tried to make much of the fact that there are analogies between the state police and the military, but quite frankly, we think that Congress and the courts and the Treasury have, for the last half century, treated them as a very special case. And in fact, the legislative evidence is all to the contrary, because Congress in 1954 enacted Section 120 of the Code, which we referred to briefly in our brief, which basically provided a $5 a day exclusion for state police troopers for subsistence allowances. And then in 1958, Congress repealed it for very much the same reason that sort of underlies our position in this case, is that after they enacted the provision, many states simply said, allocated part of the compensation of state police troopers to subsistence allowances, even though that was not the intent of what Congress was trying to do. And they said basically it worked in inequity, that it gave state police troopers something that other people didn't have. So it repealed the 120 in 1958. Now, if somehow there's an exclusion from gross income, as respondents contend, for these cash payments, then the whole congressional exercise between 1954 and 1958 is really, really a nullity. And we submit that Congress knew what it was doing. The military were special. And to the extent it addressed the problem in this case, it focused on the fact that and ultimately concluded that these cash payments to state police troopers were not to be excluded from gross income, but were to be includable. Now, if there are no further questions.
Yes, I have one, Mr. Smith. What is the government's position with respect to Section 162? Does it have any bearing on this case at all?
It doesn't have any bearing on this case, Mr. Justice Blackmun. It has more bearing in the next case. But let me simply say, for purposes of this case, Section 162 dropped out of this case by the time after the tax court, because the tax court had held that part of these cash payments to Respondent Kowalski turned out to be deductible by him because for some of the time he was away from home overnight. And to that extent, under the court's Correll decision, the tax court afforded him a Section 162 deduction. And we have not appealed that aspect of the decision to the Court of Appeals, and it's accordingly not before the court.
Do you think your opponent can rely on 162 in any respect?
I don't think so.
Because?
It doesn't seem to me that we're talking about what's left in the case is non-overnight meals. And non-overnight meals are not deductible under the court's Correll decision, which approved the commissioner's overnight rule.
Mr. Smith, I gather from your answer to Justice Blackmun's question about the treatment of military meals and lieu payments that there is no express statutory authority for treating them differently from state troopers. You've referred to the Court of Claims, Treasury regulations, and to a committee report, but there's no express statutory basis.
Yes, there is. I alluded to it briefly. It's on page 19 of our brief. 37 U.S.C. 101 paren 25 defines regular military compensation as including the federal tax advantages accruing to the aforementioned allowances because they are not subject to federal income tax. Congress, to the extent that Congress has addressed the problem, it confirmed what was the general understanding of the courts and the pertinent administrative agency, that these amounts, subsistence allowances to the military, were not taxable. And I suppose in setting military compensation, Congress takes that federal tax advantage into account.
And I suppose that statute on uniformed personnel, you are bound to read as limited to federal uniformed
Absolutely.
Personnel.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mr. Cards.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, may I first say that my name is pronounced Cordes, sir.
Cordes. We weren't given that phonetic aid today.
Before I start my main argument, I would like to correct two factual problems that I have with Mr. Smith's statement. In response to a question from Mr. Justice Marshall, Mr. Smith stated that these troopers work an eight-hour day and have a lunch break. That is not the case with respect to the New Jersey State Troopers. In 1970, they slept in barracks for much of the year that they were on duty, not under all assignments, but on Kowalski himself spent eight months of the 12 in barracks. Second thing I'd like to say about Mr. Smith's presentation is with respect to the initiation of withholding.
Is the barracks point in this case?
Yes, sir.
Was it?
It is.
Whether or not lodging is income is not in this case.
Oh, no, that's not. That is not an issue in the case. No. Mr. Smith stated that the withholding began in 1970. That's correct. The state of New Jersey started withholding on the troopers' meal allowances in response to pressure from the Internal Revenue Service, which had been going on by correspondence over a period of several years. The petitioner's argument basically comes down to the point that the meal allowance is income because there's no statutory exclusion. And in order to understand how this case fits within the long history of exceptions from gross income, several crucial facts must be emphasized. New Jersey State Police is organized along military lines, and it has unlimited statewide jurisdiction for all police functions. It's not merely a highway patrol. For more than 25 years, prior to July 1, 1949, the state of New Jersey fed its troopers at meal stations located throughout the state at the expense of the state. By 1949, the state had found that the meal station system was no longer acceptable because it took the troopers away from their police duties for too much time. Therefore, in 1949, the state abandoned the meal station system and instituted the meal allowance system in issue in this case. The meal allowance system was instituted by the state for the benefit of the state, and the meal allowance system has worked well for the state. Not only has it provided the state and the public with better police protection, but it also has been proven less expensive than the meal station system.
So do you say that adds up to the convenience of the state?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. And just as the state's furnishing of meals was not intended to represent additional compensation, the meal allowance, as the tax court found, is, quote, not intended to represent additional compensation, close quote. The state's accounting for salaries is strictly separated from its accounting for meal allowances, and the two funds are never mingled. Moreover, just
on your first point, that the substitution of the meal allowance for the meal station system was more convenient for the state than the prior system, that's enough to satisfy the test of convenience to the state. Does that mean any time you have a very inefficient system and you change to something better, that would satisfy the test?
It seems to me, Mr. Justice Stevens, that if you have a system that itself satisfies the test and you switch
but
to a
system... But by definition, your system did not satisfy the test because you found it inconvenient.
It satisfied the test in the beginning. The state had this system going for 1929.
But at the time of the change, it apparently didn't. At the time, one day before you made the change, it was obviously inconvenient to the state.
Not inconvenient, Mr. Justice, less convenient.
Well, then the test is more convenient than the predecessor system.
Which was also convenient.
Okay.
Well, the ultimate objective was to keep these men on the job 60 minutes out of every hour at all times when they were on duty. Is that not so?
That is so.
And your position is that either of them would satisfy the statute?
Definitely, either of them would satisfy the statute.
So, which statute? 61 or 119?
61.
Would not be within 61?
Would not be within 61.
Neither one would be. And you're not relying at the moment at all on 119?
Correct.
Mr. Cardes, as I understand the SG's position, it's quite immaterial whether the meals are being furnished for the convenience of the state or not. The issue is reduced, as I understand it, quite simply to whether or not they were paid in cash or the meals were furnished in kind.
That's for 119, but you're...
That's for 119.
Well, I understood the Solicitor General to make that broad generalization.
Now, 119 is quite explicit in that respect. Now, the Saunders case reached a different result. It said that it was immaterial whether they were paid in cash or were provided in kind. Is that the only case that reached that conclusion? It's addressed only to Section 61 before 119 was enacted?
Yes, it is. It's the only case that reached that conclusion with respect to a state police trooper.
A cash payment.
Cash payment. There was only one other case involving a state police trooper, a cash payment to a state police trooper prior to the 54 code, and that was the Hyslop case, which was decided by the tax court in very brief opinion and never appealed beyond that point. The Jones case, to which the SG referred, held that cash payments in commutation of meals and quarters to an Army officer were excluded under the prior version of Section 61. And in that connection, the fact that a payment is made in cash rather than kind should not be crucial for federal income tax purposes. The Internal Revenue Code, or the tax law, rather, provides an exclusion from gross income for a number of different types of cash payments without any specific statutory exclusion in the code. The meal allowances to the armed services is authorized for tax purposes only by Reg Section 1.61-2B. Supper money paid to employees who work overtime is excluded from gross income by a ruling that was issued by the Internal Revenue Bureau in 1920 and has not been modified since. Social Security benefits are excluded from gross income without any specific statutory section. Welfare benefits are excluded from gross income without any specific statutory section. And unemployment compensation itself is excluded from gross income without any specific statutory section.
Some of those exclusions from gross income are the result of court decisions, aren't they?
They are.
This wasn't a voluntary act of grace on the part of the Internal Revenue Service.
That's correct, and as was the case with the military pay exclusion, mm-hmm. that originated with a court decision. Mm-hmm. The state provides the troopers with the same meal allowance, exactly the same meal allowance. Every trooper gets the same, regardless of his length of service, and regardless of his salaries. Their salaries do increase with length of service.
And regardless of whether he eats or not.
However, we have a stipulation in this case and a finding by the tax court that the taxpayer spent at least the amount of his meal allowance for meals while in uniform on active duty.
Well, do you also have a stipulation that said no two people eat the exact amount of food?
I don't think we need a stipulation on that. The meal allowance is not calculated to provide reimbursement for any specific number of meals, but is rather an averaging device appropriate to the policy of the state of New Jersey of rotating its troopers among various assignments to give each trooper a broad range of experience.
Now, it's true, is it not, that lieutenants receive a larger meal allowance than troopers and captains receive a larger meal allowance than lieutenants?
That is true.
And majors a larger one than captains?
That is true.
And the superintendent, the largest of all.
That is true.
And no claim that they have different appetites as a class, is there?
No claim that they have different appetites. However, I have no doubt in my mind that meal allowances in the military services also increase with rank. And appropriately, the nature of the duties of the higher officers may well be such as to require them to eat in more expensive places than the troopers have to eat in. And higher officers also get a higher uniform allowance because their uniforms are more elaborate.
Well, now, wait a minute. The superintendent is driven by a trooper, isn't he?
I would assume so.
Well, I mean, they both stop and eat lunch. Why did the superintendent get more? Couldn't the trooper eat the same place he eats and eat the same food he eats?
May I say, Mr. Justice, it's not crucial to my case that the meal allowances that are paid to the superintendents and the officers are excluded from gross income.
I think involved in your case is the fact that for some reason, which up till now has not been explained, at least to me, a superintendent sitting behind a desk needs more food than a trooper running up and down the road.
I can only ascribe it to custom, just as in the military.
Well, these men aren't in them. Some of them have never been near the military.
What I'm saying is that this is a military-type organization. It's very similarly patterned to the military, as you can tell from the titles of the ranks themselves. And if they're following military practice, they probably naturally assume that officers get more than the men do.
Maybe we should adopt that in the court.
The meal allowances for meals troopers are required to eat while they are on active duty. They are on active duty when they're in uniform, performing their official duties. They are on active duty in uniform when they eat the meals for which the meal allowance is paid. They must obtain permission to eat, and their meals are frequently interrupted by the demands of their duties, and, Mr. Chief Justice, they carry radios on their persons, which enables them to be summoned by headquarters when they're eating their meal. They don't have to go out to the car to be at the radio.
Mr. Cordes, supposing you had all the same regulations about what they had to do during the lunch hour, carry a radio and where they eat and all the rest, and they did not get a meal allowance, but instead they were paid an extra $15 a day or whatever it might be. They just had a little higher salary. How would one system serve the convenience of the employer more than the other?
I think the reason that the meal allowance is paid is that they are on duty and expected to be functioning when they're eating their meals. They eat on the run. They don't have a lunch hour.
May I suggest that's not responsive to my question?
Then
my question
I didn't
is, how does one system serve the convenience of the employer more than the other, the two alternatives I gave you?
It doesn't, but this raises a question that the government has raised. They say it may well be convenient for the troopers to have their meals under these circumstances, but it's not convenient for the state to have to pay for the meals. If that's the case, it seems to me there is no convenience of the employer doctrine at all, even within the context of Section 119, because for any employer, it's more convenient to have something done the way he wants it and not have to pay for it.
Does this not come back to what Mr. Stewart himself suggested, or Mr. Smith suggested, that sometimes calling a thing by a name makes it one way or the other under tax law, as distinguished from the law generally?
That does happen sometimes, but not in this case. I don't – what it's called I don't want to get
they didn't call it pay here.
They didn't call it pay. They called it a meal allowance because it replaced a system of providing meals in kind.
Which the government, as I understand it, concedes was not taxable.
I would assume so.
This is a subject of collective bargaining and has been between the Troopers Union and the state.
It has. The Troopers Union was organized in 1968. And the meal allowance system was instituted in 1949, and the mere fact that it's a part of the collective bargaining negotiations, I don't think affects the outcome.
No, but
because
I just asked a question whether or not it is.
Certainly, but like other conditions of employment.
And I suppose it's higher now than it was in 1970.
It is. It's
as a result of
inflation.
Collective bargaining.
And collective bargaining too.
Mm-hmm. And the economy.
And the economy. And the salaries are higher now, too. Almost immediately after the state instituted the meal allowance system in 1949, the Revenue Service challenged it in the Saunders case. It was a 1950 case where the facts were, in the words of the tax court in this case, not substantially different from those in this case. Saunders excluded the meal allowance under the predecessor of Section 61 under the convenience of the employer doctrine. And this has been the law for the New Jersey State Troopers' meal allowances always under the meal allowance under the meal station system. They didn't pay tax on it under the meal allowance system. They've never paid tax on it as a result of Saunders until this case has been brought again by the government. The one point I'd like to emphasize in reaching your decision is the equity argument, that is, equal treatment among taxpayers who are similarly situated. I myself find it very difficult to draw a distinction between military officers and state police officers who are working in a state police department that functions under this system with barracks and long hours, uniforms, not being a mere highway patrol. If there is a convenience of the employer doctrine, as there must be, if the military military meal allowance exclusion is to be a valid regulation, Judge Sterrett here in the tax court found that it's difficult to conceive of a situation where an employee must so clearly take his meals at the convenience of the employer, as is the case with the New Jersey State Troopers.
But if Congress has recognized the meal allowance and so forth for military by separate statute, doesn't that remove some of the necessity for bringing it under the convenience of the employer doctrine?
Mr. Justice, I think in the statute that Mr. Smith cited, I think all that Congress has done is to recognize that there is a well-recognized exclusion.
I've checked
exclusion.
It looks like it came out of the Armed Services Committee rather than the
Right. Ways that is not a tax statute. That statute just says, look, the revenue boys have decided this, and so that's the way we'll treat this. It's not part of the tax law.
It's still a congressional recognition.
It's a congressional recognition, but
you don't suppose that the revenue people could go on and tax if in a military bill it said they won't be taxed?
I suppose that if the I think they'd be out of their minds if they tried to do it at this point. Yeah. The statutory definition of income itself is not particularly helpful. The Section 61 of the Code simply says gross income means all income from whatever source derived. So it's defining itself within itself. And as a definition, therefore, the language is defective. And therefore, these glosses have grown up on the statute over a period of time, judicially, administratively, and, of course, legislatively. Convenience of the employer doctrine is one of them. It's not the only one. It's not the most well-known one. But it's there. It has been there for a long time. And counsel for the government is saying that if you have a cash payment, you can't possibly come under the convenience of the employer doctrine. And to reach that finding, you have to decide that all cash payments are income, and it's clear that under our tax system, all cash payments are not income.
Mr. Cordes, I take it you are placing no reliance on 162.
Let me give you the context of 162 in this case. In the tax court, we briefed the 162 question. We lost the case in the tax court on a very close decision. On appeal, we briefed all three questions, Section 61, Section 119, and Section 162. The Court of Appeals, in reversing the tax court on the basis of Saunders and Judge Sarrett's dissenting opinion under Section 61, did not, in my opinion at least, reach the 119 question and did not at all reach the 162 question.
And 162 provides what?
162 provides a deduction, whereas the other two provide an exclusion from income. 162
is
a deduction.
My question is, are you relying on it?
To keep my judgment below, I certainly would rely on it.
Despite Correll?
I must say, to rely on it, limitations would have to be put on the scope of the Correll case.
So you do not agree with Mr. Smith that it just has faded back?
I don't agree with Mr. Smith that it's faded, because although the government, what the tax court did was to allow a deduction for two-thirds of the meal allowance because he was away from home two-thirds of the time. The government did not appeal from the allowance of the two-thirds deduction. We did appeal from the disallowance of the one-third deduction. Exactly. Mr. Chief Justice, unless there are further questions, I've completed my presentation.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Smith, do you have anything further?
I just have a couple of points, Mr. Chief Justice. The respondent has suggested that there's this non-statutory convenience of the employer test, which somehow suffuses Section 61 of the Code and enables him to exclude these cash payments from gross income. But even assuming, as we point out in our brief, that there is such a test, and we think that test has now been channeled exclusively into Section 119, but even assuming that he's right, that there is such a test, under that test, he has to meet two qualifications by his own analysis. He has to demonstrate that these amounts were non-compensatory, and he has to demonstrate that the cash payments were for the convenience of the employer. We submit that he meets none of those tests with respect to his own analysis. First of all, with respect to whether the amounts were compensatory, he relies on a finding of the tax court that the meal allowance was not intended to represent additional compensation. But as I pointed out in my opening argument, that is a slender read. That finding of the tax court does not say that they were not compensation. It simply said what the state hoped that they would be. And this court has said in Commissioner versus Duberstein that what the parties hope, labels put on things, what they hope the tax effect will be, is irrelevant for purposes of what the objective circumstances are. And in fact, later on in the tax court's opinion, on page 13A, they say, even though we have found that the meal allowance was not intended as additional compensation, it was obviously compensatory to a trooper to the extent that it paid for food which he otherwise would have had to pay for some other source. We conclude under Section 61 that, except as otherwise provided in the income tax law, the meal allowance received by petitioner is includable in his gross income. Now, with respect to the convenience of the employer, we submit that cash payments do not serve the convenience of the employer, because what the respondent has done is to confuse the issue by attempting to talk about all these meal restrictions. That is, you have to eat within the patrol area, you have to eat within a certain area. But the point is, he hasn't explained why those restrictions have anything to do with the convenience of the employer. All they've done is, in other words, if, as Mr. Justice Stevens has suggested, they simply paid cash, as they did, and didn't call it a meal allowance.
Doesn't it serve the convenience of the employer, that is, the state of New Jersey, that they have this man on duty and on call for 60 minutes?
Mr. Chief Justice, the meal restrictions serve the convenience of the employer, but the fact that the state of New Jersey paid cash does not serve the convenience of the employer. And we submit that is the critical question.
I go back to my hypothetical. I put to you, if they gave him a box lunch before he left the barracks, then you'd say that's not taxable.
That would qualify under Section 119 as meals in kind. That's the distinction.
It wouldn't be on the premises of the employer, though, would it?
Well, I'm assuming that I quickly, implicitly assume that the patrol car would be.
If he eats in the car, perhaps.
If he eats in the car.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.